WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hawaii. The breezes blow gently through the tousled hair of Hollywood's George Clooney lately, playing a beleaguered Hawaiian land baron in his new movie, The Descendants, as in descended from Hawaiian royalty. It's a complicated family story. Of course, the real story of Hawaii and its people is more beautiful and more tragic. And expanding west, especially the young United States, hit Hawaii like a tsunami. In her lifetime, the island's last queen went from grass hut to prisoner of a bayonet constitution and American annexation. We love Hawaii, but the history still makes your jaw drop. This hour on point, the story of Liliu Okalani, the last queen of Hawaii. You can join the conversation. Do you know this history? The missionaries, the sugar barons, the Marines, all that came before Hawaii was American. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Julia Flynn Seiler, author of the new book, Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, the Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure. You can read an excerpt from her book at our website. Julia Flynn Seiler, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
This is history that a lot of us know a little bit about, but very few know what you've dug up in all of its fullness. But what are the odds of your book coming out, Julia, at a time when not only is Hawaii in the movie theaters, but with a story about, you know, contemporary Hawaiians actually descended from some fictional, I guess, portion of the royalty you describe? This is like meteors crossing in space or something, Julia.
Well, I think you're right. I think you're right. And to have George Clooney play the descendant of the Hawaiian royal family, now that's good luck.
Is that realistic? Can you? I don't know if you hang out in Hawaii, do you bump into descendants of Hawaiian royalty? He of course is. As he says in the book, he's talking to his own family. He says, you know, we're overwhelmingly Haole, that is Caucasian or white. But that in the fictional story, there is a princess in the family line. Is that something that happens that is real in Hawaii today?
It is real. There are a number of people who are descended from Hawaiian royalty. Most of them are a mixed heritage, like the George Clooney character. But what's so astonishing, and what I learned in researching my book, The Lost Kingdom, is that the descendants of Hawaiian royalty still control very large swaths of land, like the movie, and vast fortunes. They have come down in time.
Come down in time. In the movie The Descendants, it comes down into a very, very real, very human family situation. This goes back to very grand, or also very human, real history. Here's just a little bit of the back and forth from The Descendants. This is George Clooney. He plays Met King. He's a descendant of the marriage of a Hawaiian princess, and in the movie story, a white immigrant to Hawaii. He's struggling to be a better parent to his two daughters, Alexander and Scotty. They're pretty off the hook when it starts. His wife is laying on her deathbed. He's brought his eldest daughter, Alexandra, home here from prep school, and there's a scene with her around the pool by the family manse. And suddenly the younger daughter comes out, dressed in her older sister's underwear.
Get out of my underwear, you freak!
Oh, okay, no. Back inside, put on a swimsuit.
Why?
Now!
Real good job you're doing.
That's part of why I brought you here. You have to help me with her. I don't know what to do with her.
Maybe if you spent more time with her, she wouldn't act like such a complete spaz.
Complete spaz. It's all family. It's a moving movie. I enjoyed it a lot. Did you find it a moving or a realistic portrayal of how this kind of big family question over love and life and land in Hawaii might play out, Julia?
Well, I found it extremely moving. I found one of the most poignant scenes was when the family is looking at this beautiful stretch of coastland in Kauai, and that's the land that they've owned for generations, and they're trying to decide whether to sell it or not. And And ultimately, I don't want to be a plot spoiler here, but they make a difficult decision. And it resembles very much a real situation involving the Campbell family that they encountered a few years back. And there's a kind of arcane law called the rule of perpetuities in terms of land trusts, which they have to be wound up by a certain period of time. And that's what the George Clooney character, who has the deciding vote in this trust, must decide. And
that piece of land is so beautiful that they show in the film. This fantastic stretch. We were so curious whether it was even real or not. We thought, could that be CGI, something, you know, made fantastically like a scene from Avatar? But we called the Hawaiian Film Board. It's very real. It's a stretch of land in Kauai. I think it's still owned by the Rice family, one of these big Hawaiian families that's been around there for a long, long time. Incredible cliffs sweeping down to the sea, and it's real.
It is real and interesting what are known as the Ali'i Trusts. So Ali'i is the Hawaiian word for royalty. Mm-hmm. And the Ali'i Trusts as well own giant amounts of land in Hawaii and are the biggest landlords there currently. But there are individual families as well, such as the Rices, that own big plots of land too.
The story that you tell gives us Hawaiian history. And it is kind of just astonishing history through the story of one woman, not just any woman. This is the last queen of Hawaii, Queen Liliu. And there's so many striking things about her life. We're going to talk about them. But one that just struck me is that in addition to being the last monarch, and she fought hard, she tried to push back against what was called the Bayonet Constitution. She tried to hang on to Hawaii. But in her years of essentially house arrest, imprisonment in a palace in Honolulu. But I guess before then as well, she was also a musician. She tried to preserve the heritage, ancient Polynesian heritage of her island through song, including some very famous songs. Here's one, you know, Aloha, a Farewell to Thee, her most famous song. She wrote this one in 1877. We're reading here after watching a couple of lovers in a farewell embrace on the island of Oahu. And this version is sung by Nina Kiali Wahamana.
Aloha.
Julia Flynn Seiler writes about the Queen in her book, Lost Kingdom. Julie, it is the iconic Hawaiian song. And though I knew something about this history, I had no idea that the last queen actually wrote that. She writes, "Farewell to thee, the charming one who dwells in the shaded bowers. Sweet memories come back to me, bringing fresh remembrances of the past." 1877, when she was looking back on her own memories, what might she have felt nostalgic for even at that point, Julia?
Well, I can only imagine that she felt nostalgia for a Hawaii that was rapidly disappearing under sugar plantations and the onslaught of Westerners, foreigners coming to the islands. Because at the time that she wrote that song already, Hawaii is strategically located, surrounded by thousands, 20,000 miles of Pacific Ocean, right between the West Coast and Asia. It was a perfect reprovisioning station. Her ancestors had navigated in double-hulled canoes from other Polynesian islands. And really, they had been isolated for centuries and centuries. And all of a sudden, as Western nations were looking towards Asia, Hawaii looked like a very, very tantalizing place to set up military bases and for commercial opportunities.
Captain James Cook, 1778, had shown up. The British sailor called it the Sandwich Islands because the Earl of Sandwich was what the head of the British Admiralty or something at that point. Ended up dying in Hawaii, but it wasn't so many decades after that that the missionaries came, and soon behind, after the huge success of sugar in the West Indies, came the sugar barons.
Yes, absolutely. And the first ship of missionaries arrived in 1820, and they brought with them the written word. Up until that time, Hawaii was an oral culture, and that might help explain why the queen and her family and Hawaiian people to this day are such gifted songwriters and musicians. Think of Iz. He's the enormous Hawaiian who did that the song Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which most people know.
Mm-hmm. A beautiful song, and here a Hawaiian queen ultimately imprisoned for a time. Grover Cleveland was president when a lot of this was unfolding. He spoke of the shame of what happened with the annexation push in Hawaii. Why shame, Julia?
Well, there. How do I begin to say why shame? There was no vote. Let me go backwards a little bit.
Well, Hawaii, if I may, let's just hold that.
Yeah.
Because that is a big question, and it sort of takes us right into the heart of the history, and we've got a break coming up right in front of us here. It's really fascinating history, maybe fresh in people's minds, as some have just come out of theater seeing George Clooney in the new movie The Descendants, which plays off the same history that Julia Flynn Seiler tells quite wonderfully in her new book, Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, The Sugar Canes, and America's First Imperial Adventure. Julia, stand by in San Francisco. Listeners, you can join us. Do you know how Hawaii went from independent island monarchy to American territory in 50th state? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Liliu Okalani, the last queen of Hawaii. George Clooney plays a descendant of Hawaiian royals in his new Hollywood film, The Descendants. A little bit of the soundtrack from the movie behind us. Let me tell you, it is a very good movie. The real story is better, richer, deeper, tells you a lot about that part of the Pacific and a lot about American history as well. Julia Flynn Seiler writes about it in her new book, Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, The Sugar Canes, and America's First Imperial Adventure. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us today. Do you know the story of Queen Liliu Okalani? Have you seen George Clooney in The Descendants? What did you think of his inheritance, that beautiful, vast sweep of land? What is our inheritance in this history? How do you look at this great American land grab and the fall of Hawaii's sovereignty? Was it inevitable, glorious, tragic? All of the above? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Julia Flynn Seiler joins us from San Francisco. We'll come to the moment or moments when Hawaii slips into the USA territory category, but take us back first. This queen, famously born in a grass hut, tell us about her family, how it came to power in the sort of chain of reigns in Hawaii, monarchic reigns, how she came to be queen.
Yes, she came to be queen almost accidentally, based on her birth. There was no indication that she would ever end up on the throne. She was a member of the alii, the royalty. But through diseases introduced by foreigners, many, many Hawaiians died of smallpox and other terrible scourges.
The population fell by two-thirds or three-quarters over a century, I think I read somewhere here.
Over decades, mm-hmm. very, very rapidly. It was a terrible example of guns, germs, and steel mm-hmm. in the Hawaiian Islands. And by the middle of the 19th century, Hawaii had a constitutional monarchy that was modeled after Great Britain's, It had judges. It had rule of law. It had a written constitution. It had a language, a Hawaiian language, which has been introduced by the missionaries.
And it's not as though this was by any stretch an unsophisticated place. By that time, they'd had decades and decades of interaction with explorers, traders, sugar barons, whalers, you name it. This was a real entrepot in the middle of the Pacific.
That's a very good point. And the last queen herself, Liliuokalani, was an extremely cultured woman. She was a Victorian woman. She spoke 5 or 6 languages. She had been educated by missionaries. She had gone to visit Queen Victoria in England and traveled across the United States to do that. She was highly cultured.
I'm looking here at a photograph in your book, Julia, of Liliuokalani at a luau, but it looks just like a tremendous banquet with Robert Louis Stevenson as her guest of honor. This is 1889, but this is a long way from just a fish on a rock on the beach. This is quite a cultivated woman, as you say.
Very cultivated. And that was one of the things that was so surprising to me, was how cultivated. And I loved exploring the archives and discovering letters that she had written to her niece Kailani and to others, and really revealed the human side of her. At one point, she writes a letter and she reveals that she's piqued at her husband for not having picked up the fish that she wanted, and at the same time writing letters about the strategic position of Hawaii in the world. But in any case, she was unexpectedly thrust into the throne when her brother, David Kalakaua, died very unexpectedly in San Francisco in 1891 at the Palace Hotel. All of a sudden, she became queen, and she had been very concerned about the level of debt and obligation that her brother had stacked up to the land barons in Hawaii, as well as having he had lost a number of powers on the part of the monarchy. So she wanted to take those back.
The sugar plantations had grown like Topsy. They had something like, four-fifths of all arable land was under cultivation.
Yes.
They were making huge fortunes and became the innocent bankers or lenders to the Hawaiian royalty, which was very much under their thumb in financially anyway.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And one of the most colorful of these bankers was a man from San Francisco. His name was Klaus Spreckels, and he had the nickname the Sugar King of Hawaii. He not only controlled the largest sugar plantations on the islands, but the steamship line between the West Coast and Hawaii, electric company, the biggest bank in Hawaii. I mean, he really was the Sugar King of Hawaii. And surprisingly, he was a royalist. And the reason he was a royalist is because he wanted to protect the labor laws that had been put into place under Liliuokalani's brother.
He could import very cheap labor from all over Asia, and did.
Yes. They were very favorable to the plantation owners versus the workers. There weren't many protections for the workers.
She was, her social life, even before she became queen, I mean, it's not as though she was isolated from all these foreigners who were coming in and white traders and planters and all the rest. I've got another song that she wrote here, Julia. You'll pronounce it better than me, Oinani, the beautiful native. This was written in 1886. She was still a princess, not queen. And what the thought is that this may be about a romantic affair she may have had with Henry Berger, the director of the Royal Hawaiian Band. Let's listen. Is she, Julia, writing here about an American lover?
I don't know whether he was her lover, but certainly they were close friends. And he was very much part of this resurgence that took place starting in 1883 of Hawaiian culture. Under the missionaries, they had forbidden the hula, or certainly frowned on it as being a lascivious dance. But her brother, who was known as the Merry Monarch, brought in Henry Berger as the band leader. He encouraged the public dancing of hula, which is a very expressive form of dance and storytelling. And that was shortly after that that Liliu wrote that. And I can only imagine that she felt great surge of feeling towards a fellow musician.
And someone who was respecting Hawaiian culture. In the Clooney movie, his great-great-I-forget-how-many grandmother had married, an American. In history, Liliu Ōkalani marries John Owen Dominis. Tell us about him and that relationship.
Yes. Well, John Owen Dominis was the son of a ship owner. And he had originally come from Croatia and made his way through Boston to the Hawaiian Islands. And he was trading with Asia, going back and forth from China to Hawaii. And he and his wife had built the grandest home in Honolulu, which is to this day known as Washington Place, and has become the capital. It has become the governor's mansion.
Looks kind of like a southern plantation with its pillared verandas there.
Yes, it does indeed, and it has got a glorious, glorious garden. One of the most beautiful gardens in the islands. Mm. And Liliu fell in love with John Dominis, who for a very short period of time was educated alongside her in one of the missionary schools. But he was a bit of a bad boy, and so I think that's why they fell in love. And they had a difficult marriage.
What happened to his earlier wife? Didn't you say he'd married already?
Well, no, John Dominis hadn't, but his... Yes.
His parents.
That was his first. His parents. That's who I was referring to.
I see.
He was the son of a ship captain, and they had built this marvelous mansion in Honolulu.
They had no biological children, so the story, I guess, would not be exactly like the Clooney story. On the other hand, Hawaiians, you remind us, had traditionally been very, very open to adoption.
Yes, there's a tradition in Hawaii called to hanai someone, and that is to adopt the child of someone else and take them into your family. And Liliu had three hanai children through the course of her marriage. But in terms of the descendants, the movie, that is probably most similar to Liliu's sister, Bernice Pauhi, Hanai's sister, who ended up marrying the American banker named Charles Bishop. And Charles Bishop, once his wife died, set up what is known as the Bishop Estate, which is
huge.
The most powerful Ali'i Trust. It's now known as Kamehameha Schools. And I think that is probably the more clear lineage to the George Clooney character.
In your research, bishops. When did you see Liliu Ōkalani begin to see the writing on the wall about what might be coming at her sovereign, independent monarchy in Hawaii?
Well, very, very early on. As I mentioned, she was a very sensitive, very educated person. And even going back to Pearl Harbor and talk of essentially swapping rights to what was then known as the Pearl Harbor Basin.
And you don't mean the attack. You mean the naval base, essentially.
I mean
the harbor itself.
Well, it wasn't even a harbor then. It was a potential harbor. And both British and Americans were looking at this as potentially the most important deep water port in the Pacific. And remember, you know, it was smack dab between the West Coast and Asia. And so there was discussions very early on about trying to get access to that land. And Liliu wrote in her diary after her brother had agreed to swapping this in what was known as the Reciprocity Treaty, this should not have been done. And she said that very early on. And she looked askance at a number of the things he had done over the years. And then it all came tumbling down in January of 1893. And U.S. Marines ended up marching down the streets of Honolulu. Really
off the USS Boston, you remind us.
Yes. Off the USS Boston, really on a pretext. She had discussed introducing a new constitution. That was the reason they marched. And they overthrew her in a nearly bloodless coup. And the people who overthrew her, for the most part, were from the business class. And they were Hawley. They were white foreigners.
President Grover Cleveland later said, "Hawaii is ours. As I contemplate the means used to complete the outrage, I am ashamed of the whole affair." Mari is calling from Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Mari, you're on with Julia Flynn Seiler. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I wanted to say, because I am part Hawaiian.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in Hawaii. And haole means foreigner. It does not refer to the skin of the person.
Fair. I'm glad you clarify that. Thank you, Mari.
Yes. And liliu'u is not you, but u, like when you go u,
mm-hmm.
Liliu'u Kalani.
Mm-hmm.
There is a movie, maybe you've heard of it, Princess Kai'ulani. And there is a special feature that has a documentary about her and what happened. And I think you'll find it very interesting because it is accurate history said by a professor at the University of Hawaii and other people who are Hawaiian. They told the accurate history. It's sad that the Marines came, but the Marines came because of the Hawley businessman and this writer that you are interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to dishonor her in any way. I'm sorry if I said anything that might be offensive. But the Marines came because these white businessmen wanted, you know, it was greed. So they came because of them and took over. And so when Barack Obama started to run for office for the presidency, it was actually the Hawaiian people that encouraged that. That's how that happened. But you find a very interesting documentary in that movie. And it's sad that it was illegally taken from the Hawaiian monarchy.
Mari, I appreciate your call. Let us take it right to Julia Flynn Seiler. I mean, Mari points to greed, and no question, there were huge interests here in the sugar industry and beyond. I mean, paint the pressures that were building up here from that sector of the Hawaiian population and business class at that time that led to the bayonet constitution, annexation, and all the rest.
Well, yes, I think there's some resonance for today. The economic climate was extremely uncertain. There was depression. The sugar planters were very, very concerned. They felt that the government led by the Queen was unstable, and they wanted a more stable climate for their businesses.
That's often a pretext for intervention. Do they really mean unstable or just resistant to their, to their policy appetites?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
Both. I agree with the caller. It, you know, there is a large body of feeling amongst Native Hawaiians and other scholars as well that it was an illegal overthrow. And there's an ongoing discussion about this subject.
What did they hope?
How would it happen?
How would it serve their interests for it to be annexed by the United States? How would that, I don't know, enhance their fortunes or their power?
Well, by making the ties more closer, they were hoping to encourage more trade and similar labor laws, similar taxation levels, and essentially stability. And it had been a very, very tumultuous period in Hawaiian politics leading up to the overthrow.
The beginnings, you say in your book's very title, of America's imperial outreach. Julia Flynn Seiler is with us. Her new book is Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, the Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure. That queen would end up imprisoned on her own island. You can join the conversation this hour as you hear it. What's our inheritance in this history? Was it all inevitable? Was it glorious? Was it tragic? Was Grover Cleveland right to say he was ashamed of the whole affair? And what still lives today of Hawaii's ancient heritage? You can join us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Julia Flynn Seiler, please stand by in San Francisco. A little more soundtrack from the new George Clooney movie, The Descendants. It's terrific and hinges off this period in Hawaiian history. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Liliuokalani, the last queen of Hawaii. George Clooney plays a descendant of Hawaiian royals in his new Hollywood film. The real story, better, richer, deeper, sadder in some ways. Julia Flynn Seiler tells it in her new book, Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, the Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure. You can join the conversation this hour at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Julia Flynn Seiler joins us from San Francisco. It would be a long time between the bayonet constitution and the Queen's imprisonment and Hawaii actually becoming a state, not until well after World War II, Julia, that finally happened. Was that seen as coming from the very beginning here, or was it unclear?
Do you mean, was it inevitable that it would
the
become
statehood.
A...
statehood. I mean, there are other territories. Look at Puerto Rico. Never became a state, but there's Hawaii.
No, I don't think it was inevitable, but certainly after what happened, the surprise Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7th, and the enormous shock to the nation, I think it was inevitable after that that it would become a nation, or
was
become
it,
a state, was the 50th state.
Was it clear in the 19th century that it would be an American territory one day? I mean, they were not the only ones there. British were there, French were there.
No. That was one of the biggest surprises to me, that Hawaii was almost like a bride who was being courted by the British, the French, the Americans, even the Japanese were flirting with Hawaii. I mean, who would have thought? And can you imagine a turn in history where perhaps Hawaii had become a Japanese territory instead?
That would have been a very different picture. Let's take some calls here. Sebastian in West Harwich, Massachusetts. Sebastian, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Julia. What I'd like most to hear about is the role of early missionaries in what I believe to be stealing vast tracts of Hawaiian land.
Well, I would have to agree with you that the overall story is one in which, a Gilded Age land grab. And if you look at the numbers, something like 1.8 million acres of land went from the Hawaiians to Americans at the time of the overthrow. And the last queen fought to try to get those lands back through her life. She died in 1917, and there were lawsuits, and she did not succeed in that effort. That said, the missionaries did a lot of good, too. And we must remember that they brought reading and writing to the Hawaiians. And they came with very good intentions, but the cliche, of course, is that they came to do good, and they did very well indeed.
How did they make the transition from missionary work to giant landholders and businessmen? Was that, children of the missionaries? Did it happen within lifetimes? Did people lay down their Bibles and, you know, pick up the ledger book? How did that transition happen?
Well, in some cases, it happened very, very fast. For example, Liliu's school teacher, who taught her to read and write, finally ended up leaving the mission and starting a business. And the business soon grew, and his descendants, his sons, became very involved in Liliu's overthrow, which is one of the sad ironies of this story.
What was the relationship between the monarchs and these missionaries. I mean, you remind us of one in particular, Walter Murray Gibson, kind of adventurer here. He came out to Hawaii as a Mormon missionary, excommunicated, and became the king's prime. This is before Liliu Kalani, but became the prime minister to the native Hawaiian king.
Oh, he could not have invented a character like him. He only seemed to, you know, thrive in the heady climate of Gilded Age Polynesia, I think, Walter Murray Gibson. He was quite an amazing person. He learned to speak Hawaiian, not only spoke Hawaiian, but published a Hawaiian language newspaper and became a populist. He was an advocate for Hawaii for Hawaiians, and that was one of the reasons he drew so close to the king. The king liked his message. He was a very manipulative man and a great orator. One of the most wonderful stories was that he ended up dying in San Francisco, exiled from Honolulu on corruption charges. His body was brought back to Honolulu and laid out, and some of the white missionary descendants came to visit him. One was Sanford Dole, the uncle of the Dole pineapple founder.
Remind us about... please go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to finish the story. They looked at his body, which had turned strangely dark, and said his the color of his skin resembles the color of his soul.
Wow.
So,
okay.
Wow.
There's an epitaph. And what about Sanford Ballard Dole? This is also a missionary's son in the family of the Dole Food Company, the Hawaiian Pineapple Company. But a missionary son who played a key role in the overthrow of the Liliu and afterward expressed remorse.
He did express remorse privately in a letter to his brother George. Sanford Dole was physically a very very prominent man. He was 6'4" or something. He was a lawyer, and he became the first president of Hawaii and really was, you know, intimately involved in Liliu's overthrow and ended up occupying the palace, Iolani Palace in downtown Honolulu. His role is very conflicted and another kind of sad story.
How long was she held prisoner in the Iolani Palace there?
She was held prisoner for 8 months in 1895, and one of the most moving documents that I found was in the Bishop Museum in Honolulu, and it was a page that Liliu had torn from the Book of Psalms, and she had written in pencil, "Iolani Palace, January 16th, 1895, am imprisoned in this room by the government of the Hawaiian Republic for the attempt of the Hawaiian people to regain what had been wrested from them by the children of the missionaries who first brought the word of God to my people." I got what the Hawaiians call chicken skin reading this, holding this page of the Bible that she had written.
Wow.
And that was the first night of her imprisonment.
Well, we have another piece of music from her written by the Queen, and in fact written when she was a prisoner there. This is often called the Queen's Prayer. At the bottom of the manuscript, she wrote, composed, and this is right in the same vein, composed during my imprisonment at Iolani Palace by the missionary party who overthrew my government. Here's a bit of that.
Ko nani ko'u ko'o. My nana ino ino, na heva o kanaka, akai hui ka, amae mae no.
The Queen's Prayer there, written by the Queen, sadness in the song, and also irony, Julia Flynn Seiler. It sounds to me anyway, you look at the lyrics here, your loving mercy is as high as heaven and your truth so perfect. I live in sorrow, imprisoned. You are my light, your glory, my support. It seems as though it's a kind of appeal or praise to a Christian deity here by a queen imprisoned by the missionary party, as she describes it.
There is an irony, but I found it so moving that Liliu never lost her faith. In fact, she was such an inspiring character to me, a person to me, because she ended up forgiving her enemies.
And was she Christian explicitly?
She was deeply Christian. Mm-hmm. She was a choir director at the church for decades, in addition to writing songs. She was deeply Christian. And even though some of her most vicious enemies came from the church, I mean, on the church pulpits in Honolulu, they were calling her savage and immoral. And the newspaper headlines were calling her bloodthirsty. But she was Christian.
Let's go to Claire in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Claire, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to offer my experience. I'm descended from three different, well, I'm originally from Hawaii. I'm descended from three different missionary families, including my great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, who's William O. Smith, who was part of the provisional cabinet, but then later became Liliuokalani's either personal lawyer or the trustee of her estate, wow, depending on who in the family you believe.
Mm-hmm.
But in going through my grandmother's personal papers after she died about 15 years ago, I came across an envelope that had, I opened it up, it didn't have any description on the outside other than William O. Smith's papers, and it turned out to be a collection of letters that were handwritten by Liliuokalani, and they were a set of letters that were sent to the different consulates protesting that she had the overthrow of the government and her imprisonment in Iolani Palace.
Wow.
And
mm,
that was an extremely moving moment to have, you know, beholding in my hands these letters that she had written herself.
Claire, may I ask you, you know, Americans look at Hawaii with, I would say, a lot of love. It's a beautiful place and a lot of pride that it's a 50th state. But there is this history, and it's hard history. You're descended from three of these missionary families. Now, your most prominent ancestor may have worked with the last queen, but at the same time, you were part, your family was part of that influx that maybe...
Well, it's incredibly complicated, and I have very mixed feelings about how we came to get what we had. Part of the family went into ranching, part of it went into pineapple, and also sugarcane. So they, you know, it's not too dissimilar from the movie with George Clooney, but it's you know, it has its emotional baggage that goes with it. And I've chosen to neither blanketly vilify or you know, defend the
yeah,
missionaries. I feel that it's a history that I, you know, I just have to understand and appreciate from every angle. And I wanted to also say that the newest book by Sarah Vowell, Unfamiliar Fishes, has a really incredible overview of the politics and the whole timeline that brought us to this point.
I appreciate your call so much, Claire. Letters from the Queen in the Family. It's incredible. History just rolls right down to us. One more right here from Charleston, Massachusetts. Alex. Alex, you're on the air.
Well, she just mentioned the book I was going to talk about, Unfamiliar Fishes by Sarah Vowell.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Tom, by the
way. Hi.
So one of the things they talked about, which was really interesting, was all of the incest that went on in the royal family and how brothers and sisters were married to each other and their uncles and children. I wondered if you had a comment about that.
Julia, was that tradition? Was that culturally accepted in the Hawaiian royal family? Or?
Well, there was certainly an instance very early on, but by the time that Liu was born, that was not anything that I found. And there's a lot of mythologizing about Hawaii and making fun of it. And certainly Mark Twain went to Hawaii for 5 months in the mid-19th century, and then delivered more than 100 lectures around the United States. And he took ideas like the Hawaiians ate dogs, and they had orgies, and they did this and that.
And
there's a little bit of that going on as well now.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
made a living off of it, mm-hmm, because it's, you know, and that continues
exotic
this day,
mm-hmm,
with the Brady Bunch going to Hawaii in the 60s and seeing tiki gods, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of information that is not very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that.
Alex, thanks for your call. Deb in Lebanon, Connecticut. Deb, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for my call.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really quick story. When I had the pleasure of visiting the Hawaiian Islands, I did all of the historic sites that I possibly could, including the Queen's Summer Palace. And I was going through there, and the docent was relating the story of the Queen. I was so moved by it, so sad by it, that as I was walking around, tears were just streaming down my face. I don't think I was being obvious about it, but after the tour was over and we were about to leave, the docent walked over to me and put her hand on my arm and said, "It's okay. It was a very long time ago." So I think it just kind of shows the resignation of the Hawaiian people. Obviously, she was a native born.
Deb, you're breaking up, but I appreciate your call. Julia?
I would like to comment on that, if I may.
Yes.
First of all, I would not characterize the stance now as resignation by any means. Mm. I think that there is an incredible resurgence of interest and love in Hawaiian culture going on right now with Hawaiian music and hula. There are hula halaus or hula schools all over the United States, the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I would have to say that there is a very interesting thing that goes on once a year. It's called the Forgiveness Project, inspired by the Queen. And again, it's not resignation, it's forgiveness. Ironically, the Forgiveness Project for many years has been taking place on Dole Street in downtown Honolulu.
Wow. Right there, named after the pineapple fortune and all the business that came in there. And the imperialism piece, you say, you know, the first imperial adventure. I mean, the Spanish-American War would come and much more, the Philippines after this. But here in balmy Hawaii, that kind of impulse first taking foot abroad.
Well, and I think what is so unusual is that Hawaii was an independent nation, and we took it over. And that was the first time America had done that, and it was very significant. I'd also like to say that it didn't really happen because of sugar, strangely. What really happened was the Spanish-American War was brewing. In Cuba, the Maine had just blown up, and we needed a place to coal for a coaling station and reprovision ships on the way to the Philippines. And that's what brought it about.
And
annexation.
From such history, islands move, at least the flags move over them. Liliuokalani's statue stands proudly outside today, outside the Hawaiian State Legislature. Julia Flynn Seiler has joined us from San Francisco. Her new book is Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, The Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure. Julia, thank you very much for being with us today. Fascinating story.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The dream that you dare to, why, oh, why can't I?